This is Julie Cully with History and Murders of Wichita Falls. What a week it has been. I've been called a racist because as an historian, I don't want to have a Civil War statue taken down, a memorial dedicated to future generations. I've had an argument with a man who proudly claims to be an anarchist and wants to abolish the police. We somehow settled our dispute, or maybe I just quit talking to him. And I've been told that I am offensive and disrespectful for telling stories about murders during this time. The poster was referring to the pandemic. So if you have something to say, post it on the Julie Cully, Wichita Falls, Texas author Facebook page. Let's make it public so everyone can respond. Help me finish out my week. So one warning about this next story. Listener discretion is advised. There is a section in the story where I talk about body parts that are not attached to a body. So let's get started. The first school massacre occurred in 1764. When Indian warriors entered a schoolhouse in Pennsylvania and shot and scalped the teacher and several students. The deadliest school incident happened in 1927 in Bath Township, Michigan, where 45 children and adults were killed and another 58 were wounded when a disgruntled school board member set off a series of bombs on the school campus. Some people might remember the University of Texas Tower Killer, in which Charles Whitman killed 16 people, including a police officer. Of course, in recent years, no one can forget Columbine High School in Colorado, Virginia Tech, and Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut. Some people may not remember the Poe Elementary School bombing in an upscale neighborhood in Houston in 1959. The school was located near Rice University, and the headline in the newspaper the next day read, "Poe School Blast Set Off by Mad Bomber Kills Six." To many children and adults, it was a day they will never forget. Paul Ogeron and his son Dusty traveled from place to place, sometimes living in Paul's car. He wanted to settle down and get his son into the best school in Houston. Paul had not had the best life. He had a criminal record, which included charges for theft and burglary. He was also known as a safecracker. He spent time in the West Feliciana Parish, Louisiana State Penal Farm, in 1940, and in Huntsville Prison in Texas in 1930. He fathered a child by his stepdaughter, and he and his wife were divorced. She said he was very abusive, but she said Paul adored his son Dusty. The two went everywhere together, and the boy was always by his side. On September 15, 1959, Paul Ogeron walked into the Poe Elementary School to register Dusty at the school. At the time, he was carrying a briefcase. He was given a form to fill out, which included his current address, his former address, the name of Dusty's former school, and other common information. Paul couldn't even answer the simple questions, such as current address. He didn't even have Dusty's birth certificate to prove who he was. The office worker told him he would have to complete the form before the boy could be registered at the school. Paul said that he would get the information and return the next day, leaving out the front door of the school. A few minutes later, Paul and Dusty appeared on the playground of the school. He was still carrying his briefcase at about 10 o'clock. There were 5 first and second grade classes on the playground at the time for recess. Paul stopped in front of teacher Patricia Johnston, who'd been a teacher there for 10 years, and he told her to gather all the children around in a circle. At first, she thought he had something obscene in the briefcase. But she yelled to the children to just get away. He handed Miss Johnston 2 notes, but because of the handwriting, they were very difficult to read. One of the notes said, "Please do not get excited over this order that I'm giving you. In this suitcase you see in my hand is filled to the top with high explosive. I mean, high. Please believe me when I say I have two more bombs that are set to go off at two times. I do not believe I can kill and not kill what is around me. And I mean my son will go. Do as I say and no one will get hurt, please. Do not get the police department yet. I'll tell you when. And I would like to talk about God while waiting for my wife. Paul showed Miss Johnston a button on the bottom of his briefcase that looked like a doorbell. He told her that all he had to do was set the briefcase down on the ground and it would blow everyone around them to smithereens. He set one end of the briefcase on the ground and the other on the tip of his shoe, so the doorbell wouldn't touch the ground. Miss Johnston sent students into the school to get help. The teacher backed away and started gathering the children to get them safely back into school. At the entrance to the building, she saw the school custodian, James Montgomery. She told him that the man on the blacktop said he had dynamite in his suitcase. And Paul yelled, "Stay away from here or I'll blow you to pieces." James Montgomery went towards the man and lunged at him to try to tackle him. The briefcase slipped off of his toe and hit the ground. The dynamite exploded with such a force that it sent bodies flying. You could smell burning flesh and see body parts and flesh all over the area. The explosion left a huge crater in the asphalt. Paul Ogeron and his son Dusty were apparently obliterated. It wasn't until some time later when they found Paul's hand 50 feet away in the bushes and ran the fingerprints so that they were sure that Paul was dead. Pieces of flesh were hanging from the trees and bushes. Paul Orgeron's missing right shoulder and arm landed all the way across the street and were found on the roof of a two-story house. His foot was found on the asphalt near the blast scene. Another man who lived across the street from the school found a piece of flesh in his backyard. It was a horrific sight to see. Paul Ogeron, his son Dusty, the custodian James Montgomery, a teacher Jenny Coulter, and two students, Billy Halls Jr. and John Fitch Jr., were all killed in the blast. The principal of the school, Mrs. R.E. Doty, was injured on the ground, along with 17 children who were injured and strewn across the playground area. One boy who would later have to have his foot amputated cried, "That mean old man, why did he have to do that?" That's the question everyone was asking. It did, however, traumatize some of the students. Each person's psyche is different. Some of the students weren't affected in any way by the explosion. Others were affected for life. Bill Thomas was sitting in his classroom when everything happened. He said the blast shattered windows and blew a clock off the wall. To him, it sounded as if someone had shot off a shotgun right beside his ear. Bill thought the school was under Soviet attack. It was a time when everyone thought the U.S. would have a nuclear attack. School children would go through drills at school. They were taught to duck and cover under their desks in their classroom. These drills scared many a child during this time. When the explosion was over, the children were escorted out of the buildings, past the bodies and body parts to the front of the school. Bill Thornton said it looked like a war zone, something he would never forget. In Mrs. Coulter's classroom, Susan Cooley flushed the toilet. Then there was the huge explosion from the dynamite in Ogeron's briefcase, and Susan blamed herself for the blast. She wondered what she could have done to make that blast. She thought she'd flushed the toilet too hard. Probably the most affected student at that time was Larry Schacht. His high school girlfriend said that he was always angered by that day, feeling betrayed by the lack of empathy for all of the children of the school that day. Life just returned to normal the very next day, and no one ever asked the children how they were doing. He told his girlfriend that because of all the duck and cover drills the kids had to constantly go through, they were afraid of the bomb. Schacht said that no one ever talked to them and told them what really did happen. He turned to drugs, including intravenous drug use. But in the 70s, however, he somehow managed to clean up his act and someone paid for him to go through medical school. By 1977, he was a doctor in a hospital in San Francisco. Schacht was so disheartened with the United States that he went to South America to become a missionary. He served as a doctor at the People's Temple Agricultural Project with the Reverend Jim Jones. It was Larry Schacht who came up with the idea of creating a grape-flavored cyanide-laced drink, the same Kool-Aid drink that 918 of Jones' followers would eventually drink in 1978 in Jonestown during a mass suicide, including Schacht himself. For more stories like this, check out my last book called How Did They Die? Murders in Northern Texas, 1954 to 2011. That one's the book with the red cover, and you can find them all at Heritage Antique Mall at 15th and Lamar, or Pickers Universe at 10th in Indiana in Wichita Falls. Or if you don't live in Wichita Falls, you can find them all on Amazon.com. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. Bye. I have written 8 books about Wichita Falls and North Texas. I have 4 in a series called How Did They Die? Murdered in Northern Texas. One is from 1892 to 1926. One is 26 to 74. One is 54 to 2011. And then I have Murdered in the Line of Duty. So it's about officers around Texas who have been killed in the line of duty. I've also written 4 picture books. One is called Views of the Past, Downtown Wichita Falls. One is Views of the Past, Downtown Wichita Falls, Volume 2. One is Views of the Past, Wichita County, Texas. And the last one is called Way Back When, a picture book for kids. Y'all can get any of these books at Pickers Universe at 10th and Indiana, Heritage Antique Mall at 15th and Lamar, and please shop locally if you live here, or you can order them on Amazon.com. Just type in my name and my books will pop up. Thank y'all.